With the following issue. Today we're going to depart from what we normally do, and we're going to look totally, our entire focus is going to be not on the world of Mikra, but on the world of Midrash. And I'm going to start with a general question. Is it an accurate statement to say the rabbis viewed Purim as, and then have any sort of ending to that sentence? The answer is no. Matter of fact, to ask almost any question and to answer it by saying the rabbis held that or believed that or maintained that without a qualifier is almost always inaccurate, because the reality is that the rabbis are exactly that. This is plural. And different people have different perspectives. There were different methods of learning. There was Rabbi Akiva versus Rabbi Ishmael and the different hermeneutical rules. There were different approaches to understanding how one ought to live his life. So, for instance, the famous machloket between Rabbi Yisrael and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai about the role of work. All sorts of other disputes in perspective, in attitude, in learning styles, in how to read Mikra. And the same is very much true about the holiday we're about to celebrate, about Purim. And I want to look at it through the lens of Midrash. And here we have a particular gift that we don't normally have. Midrashic literature is, by and large, contained in several collections, which we refer to by the sort of nickname of Midrash. Midrash Rabbah, Midrash Tanchuma. These are collections. They were never composed as books. A Midrash was, like the Ramban says in the famous Vikuach, like a sermon. The rabbi would get up before the Kriyah, and he would relate something about either something in the reading about to happen, and then add in all sorts of midrashic traditions about what it was to illuminate, to teach a lesson, or else, often as not, would start somewhere very different in a very tangentially, if at all, related pasuk somewhere else, and weave and end up with a pasuk in our parasha, in the parasha that's about to be read. Now, that's why we have a whole treasure trove of Midrashim on all five books of Chumash and on all five Megillot, and we do not have the same for almost any other part of Tanakh. We have nothing close to it for any other part of Tanakh besides those, because those are the things that were publicly read. And therefore, as part of the public reading, there was this presentation. Almost all of the Midrashim that we have in the famous collections are Midrashei Eretz Yisrael. Almost all of the names of the Chachamim that you hear in there are Chachmei Eretz Yisrael. And by the way, talk about specialization. Many of the names that you hear over and over in the Midrashim are names that you will not encounter in the Talmud, because they are experts in Midrash and not experts in Halakha. And some of the names that you would expect to hear over and over in the Midrashim, because they're well known from Halachot, from Eretz Yisrael, are hardly mentioned because that's not their area of expertise. And we have stories like that in the Gemara about rabbis who have an expertise in one area or the other, and that's how they teach. The reason I'm giving that whole long introduction is because Esther is something of an anomaly. We do not have an extensive Babylonian Midrash on Rut, or on Shir HaShirim, or even on Chumash. We do have little collections. There's a little sugya on the fifth parak of Babatra about Rut, and there's sugyot here and there about Shir HaShirim with Midrashim. But the large collection of Midrashim that we have that goes in order, interpreting Shir, and we did this a couple years ago before Pesach, the Midrashim of Shir HaShirim are all Midrashei Eretz Yisrael. The collections are all Midrashei Eretz Yisrael. Esther stands alone as giving us a rich entire weave of how Megillat Esther was perceived and taught in Bavel, and that is in the collection of what's called the Babylonian Esther Midrash, that's what they like to refer to it, which occupies the second half of the first chapter of Masachet Megillah. It is long, it is detailed, and it is sequenced. So that unlike other midrashim you'll find scattered in the Talmud to take a pasuk here or a pasuk there, it starts from Vayhi Bimei Achashverosh and gives the famous midrash. Every time it says Vayhi, it means terrible troubles and has that discussion. And why is his name Achashverosh? Because anybody who remembers him says, oh yeah, I have a headache, Ach L'Roshi, and all of the famous midrashim, including some of them clearly tongue-in-cheek, all the way ending with the last words of the Megillah, Dover Shalom L'chol Zaro, but Ratzui L'Rov Echad, and the famous Midrash, that not everybody was happy with the fact that Mordechai got involved with politics, and all through, and this is unique because it gives us a window into seeing how Esther was taught in Bavel. Why is that helpful? Because it also, importantly, gives us a view as how to see how the Chachmei Bavel, the sages in Bavel, viewed the story of Purim. And Hafle Vafela, it is wondrous to see that when we look through Midrashei Eretz Yisrael and compare them to Midrashei Bavel, we come out with two different viewpoints on understanding what happened and understanding the miracle. I'm going to start not at the beginning, because that would be against the spirit of Purim. I'm going to start not at the end, because that would be too much in the spirit of Purim. We've got another week to go. So we'll start in the middle. Take a look at Source 5 on the top of, thank you, Julie Andrews. I will start on the top of the second page with Source 5, with a very well-known Gemara. Those of us who grew up in Bnei Akiva know this Gemara very well. The Gemara asked the question about reciting Hallel on Purim. It goes through the different days that we say Hallel and why we do, and then it says, Purim de'ika nisa lema. After all, if the criterion for saying Hallel on a particular day is either that it is a particularly festive day, Moed, etc., or that it's a day of a nes like Chanukah, then we should say Hallel on Purim. They have three very famous answers to this question. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, l'fisha'en omim hashira al nes shivachutz ala'aretz. So he gives the first explanation, which is, we do not say thanksgiving, shira, praise songs, for a miracle that happens in chutz la'aretz. Okay? This is challenged by Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak in Bavel. Rabbi Yitzchak, by the way, who is not his father, Rabbi Yitzchak is a chacham in Eretz Yisrael. It's critical to know that because the community of sages in Eretz Yisrael and the community of sages in Bavel at the time had very different perspectives on where they were. The sages in Bavel, by and large, held that Bavel had a certain historic and destiny-related sanctity. Rav Yehuda famously forbade his students to leave Bavel to make Aliyah, because we're supposed to stay in Bavel. Professor Gaffney has lectured numerous times and written about the, if you will, Jewish patriotism about Bavel, about what it meant to be in Bavel. This, of course, is something that Chachmei Eretz Yisrael had no use for and used to regularly ridicule Chachmei Bavel. You live in a dark place, that's why you say dark things, foolish Babylonians who eat bread with bread, etc., all these kind of statements. So, Rabbi Yitzchak, a Chacham Eretz Yisrael, says, we do not say Hallel on Purim because it happened in Chutz La'aretz. Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak challenges this and says, wait a second, the very core of Hallel is Pesach. And Pesach happened in Chutz La'aretz. So he answers, you're right. All the way, as long as we were in Chutz La'aretz, until the Jewish people arrived home, the whole world was an available place for Hallel. Once we came into the land, the rest of the world became invalidated. Sort of like the difference between being single and being married. When you're single, everybody's available. Once you're married, then that's it. So in the same way. Now, that's the first answer. Rav Nachman in Bavel gives a different answer. And what's his answer? We do say Hallel. What do we say? Kriyata zuhi halilah. That the reading of the Megillah is the Hallel. Now, to get into the nuts and bolts of this sugya would take us too long, but I'll just give you the quick version of it. Rav Nachman clearly holds that you do say Hallel on a miracle that happened in Chutz La'aretz. However, he says, what's Hallel? Hallel is saying canonized text of praise. So when it comes to Yitzhak Mitzrayim, we have Hallel, it's called Hallel Mitzrayim, B'tzeit Yisrael, etc. When it comes to this, we've got an entire canonized text to read. Hanukkah, we don't have a canonized text, so we say the Hallel Mitzrayim. Hallel Mitzrayim is like a fallback. But we don't need a fallback because we got something better, which is Megillat Esther. Rava, who is Rav Nachman's student, says that I fundamentally agree with you, however.
Wait, this is in Bavel?
It's all in Bavel. By the way, the code here is that the blue background is Bavel, blue for Bavel, and the yellow is for Eretz Yisrael. yellow Israel, and I have no idea what if there's any linguistic connection. Okay, Rav Amar, Bishta Mahatam Halu Avdei Adonai Velu Avdei Paro. He said, I'll tell you the difference. Because after all, when we left Egypt, what is the opening line of Hallel? Give praise, ye servants of God. And the implication is servants of only God, because you're no longer servants of Paro. You can't say that here because we are still enslaved to Achashverosh, which means that Rava and his teacher Rav Nachman agree, sitting in Bavel, that a miracle in Chutz La'aretz and a miracle in Bavel would certainly rank and would merit Hallel. Rav Nachman says you don't need Hallel because you got it, and that's Kriyat Megillah. Rava says we should say Hallel, but we can't because of a technicality, because Hallel addresses an autonomous, sovereign people, and we're not autonomous and sovereign even after the miracle. We're still enslaved to Achashverosh. Fine.
How would it explain the Book of Roots?
What?
The Book of Roots. We still
There's no Hallel. There's no Hallel in Root.
No, I know, but you're saying that Hallel is replaced by the Megillah.
Well, that's only if you need a Hallel, so you've got the Megillah. Root is not replacing a Hallel. Right, and on Shavuot we're thanking God because it's the festive time. So we say Hallel. We also read the story of Ruth. But here, the idea is that you're reading the story that itself is the miracle you're celebrating, so that's the Hallel. But the point is that you see a fundamental divide between Rabbi Yitzchak and Eretz Yisrael, who says, very quickly, you don't say Hallel because it didn't happen here. It happened in Chutz La'aretz. Chutz La'aretz just doesn't count. And in Bavel, the reaction is, of course it counts. And either we do say Hallel, or there's a technicality. And another reason we don't say Hallel, but not because of an inherent problem with being in Chutz La'aretz. Okay? Now, Jason, you had a question.
Does Rava agree with Rav Nachman that the Megillah is a replacement?
Sorry. Okay. So now, let's take a look at the beginnings, right? And this now really is a very good place to start.
Yes.
For us to see where a lot of this starts. The Mishnah in Masechet Megillah presents us with an interesting question that probably, until you saw it, you never would have thought to ask, which is, how much of the Megillah do you have to read? You never think to ask it because we're all God. We read the whole Megillah. That's why we got a whole Megillah. We read the whole thing. The Mishnah asks the question, Eichan Adam Koreh Ta Megillah V'Yotzei Ba'Yedei Chovato. So from what point, everybody agrees you have to read until the end, but from what point do you have to read to fulfill the mitzvah? Rameh Omer Kula. What's Rameh's statement? You have to read the whole thing. And that's, of course, the halacha. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mi'ish Yehudi. Ish Yehudi means the introduction of Mordechai. Rabbi Yossi Omer Mi'achar Dvar Ma'ela, which is the introduction of Haman. And then in source 2, you see a fourth opinion in the Tosefta that's either Rabbi Shimon or Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We'll just call him Rabbi Shimon because that's easy. It says Balayla Hahu, which is the night the king couldn't sleep. Okay, so four different opinions. Right now, the Gemara, source 4, assays these opinions, and I have to tell you, I've seen this Gemara many times and never really noticed the important divide between it. When you find a halakha, and the halakha is inferred from a verse, and then you find another chacham come and say, I inferred it from a different verse, we often kind of skate over and said, well, you like that verse and you like that verse, and not a big deal. Here, I think there's something much deeper going on. Let's take a look at it. The first statement belongs to Rabbi Yochanan, who is basically the chief rabbi of history. If you look through the Gemara, you will find that Rabbi Yochanan plays the role of chief rabbi more than anybody else. Because Rabbi Yochanan is the Chacham of Eretz Yisrael in Tveria, at the last period during which the Piskei Halacha of Tveria still have binding authority over Bavel. It's only after Rabbi Yochanan that Bavel sort of declares independence and starts paying attention to the Piskei Halacha from Eretz Yisrael. And Rabbi Yochanan's name is, I don't know, I haven't done a survey on it, but is probably among the, if not the most prominent name of Amoraim mentioned in all of the Gemara. In Bavel, Talmud Bavli, even though he's in Tveria. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says these four opinions about how much of the Megillah you have to read. Kulam nikra echad darshu. They're all reading the same pasuk in the Megillah, and they're interpreting it differently. What's the pasuk? Vatichtov Esther HaMalkah Mordechai HaYudi et kol tokef. So if you take a look above in the large text in Perek Tet, it says that Esther and Mordechai wrote et kol tokef. Simple pshat in the context means they wrote with all of the authority. because they wrote this as a royal document that had all the authority of a royal document. However, Rabbi Yochanan says that's what these four chachamim are interpreting. Mande Amar Kula, the one who says you have to read the entire Megillah, says Tokfo Shel Achashverosh, meaning, what did Mordechai and Esther write? They wrote the power. Whose power? Achashverosh's power. Where is Achashverosh's power described? In the beginning, with the party. Man de amar mi ish Yehudi, the second opinion says, Rabbi Yehuda says you have to read from ish Yehudi, Tokfo Shel Mordechai, meaning they wrote about the story, the power of Mordechai. And Mordechai, of course, only appears after he's introduced. That's Perek Bet. Man de amar mi achar dvarim ha'elet, right? Tokfo Shel Haman. They wrote about the power of Haman and how the power of Haman was, of course, defeated. And Man Damami Balai Lahu, the one who has that very late opinion that says that we start the reading the Megillah when the king can't sleep, is Tokfo Shel Nes, the power of the miracle, because that's when everything falls apart. Now, what does that mean? It means as follows. Rabbi Yochanan is saying that these four rabbis are not looking at disparate psukim for hints as to how much must be read. They are in an accord that the key verse that defines what must be read is called Tokef, and the word is Tokef. Because that's at the end of the Megillah, Esther and Mordechai wrote Kol Tokef. They simply disagreed whose power is being described, power of Achashverosh, power of Mordechai, power of Haman, or power of the miracle. Notice, of course, that Esther is not one of the opinions here. Okay? Just important to point out. That's Rabbi Yochanan. That's in Eretz Yisrael. Now, Rav Huna. Who's Rav Huna? Rav Huna is the closest student of Rav. That, of course, is in Bavel. What does Rav Huna say? Mehacha. He has a different pasuk. Uma ra'u akacha, uma higi aleihem. Now, the end of Perek Tet, the end of the ninth chapter, which we studied last week in the context of looking at the establishment of Purim, the end of it has some very bizarre phrases. Some phrases that are hard to figure out in their summing up. There's a summary of the story in a few psukim, which itself is kind of hard to untangle. And then there's a description of the development and the acceptance of the holiday. In that, it starts out with posing a rhetorical question. Ma ra'u al kacha u'ma higi aleihem. Why did they see things this way, and why did they deserve this? They being the Jews, and this is the celebration of Purim. Out of context, it's read as follows. The opinion who says you have to read the whole Megillah says, Mara'a, meaning, Mara'a Achashverosh, Nishtamesh B'Kelim Shel Beit HaMikdash. Why did Achashverosh decide to use the Kelim Beit HaMikdash? We're all familiar with the Midrash, that Achashverosh made a calculation and said, the Jews have not been redeemed by now, they'll never be redeemed again because the 70 years have come and gone. Now I can go out and take the Kelim Beit HaMikdash and use them on a big party. That's why he delayed the party till the third year. And then, of course, immediately all hell broke loose, and that was the end of Vashti, and from there it goes on. That's the Midrashic direction. Why did Achashverosh make that mistake? Al kacha, mishum lechashiv shivim shonin v'lo yifruk, because he made a calculation that was wrong. Umayi gialem, and what was the result? Vashti was killed. And then they do this too with everything. So what with the one who says that we read from Ishudi, it's, why did Mordechai refuse to bow to Haman? We've talked about that in the past, and the Midrashic direction here is because Haman declared himself to be an Avodah Zarah. And what happened? The miracle happened. Chayit Vayimayela, why did Haman suddenly decide? Now, notice there's a thread here. Think of the thread. Why did Haman suddenly decide to go try to kill all the Jews? Because Mordechai wouldn't bow down. And what happened? He ended up himself swinging in the wind. And then, Balai Lahahu, why did Achashverosh suddenly decide to have the Chronicles brought before him in the middle of the night? Because Esther invited Haman to a party, and it was all unclear what was happening, and he was concerned about the plot. And what happened in the end, there was a miracle. Now, what's the thread here? The thread here in taking this pasuk out of its pshat and out of its context is that key people in this story behave bizarrely, and it's not a word. They behave in an unpredictable and unexplainable fashion. Why does Achashverosh suddenly do this weird thing of pulling out the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash? The answer is because he made a calculation. Now, let's stop and think about that. He made a calculation that the Jews aren't going to be redeemed, so their God must have given up on them, so it's okay to do this. You really want to mess with the God who's so powerful because you think your math is good? That's not very smart, and of course he ended up paying for it. and the party went crazy, and Vashti was killed, etc., in the Midrash. Or, why did Mordechai not bow down to Haman? Because Haman declared himself to be an Avodah Zarah. And if you think about it, we've talked about this in the past, the whole thing is irrational. And from the perspective of that Midrash, Haman's declaring himself to be an Avodah Zarah is irrational for several reasons. First of all, because, are you serious? And second of all, because it defeats the entire purpose of the bowing. If the whole bowing is to bring him personal pride, he's going to lose it if they're not bowing to him, but to an Avodah Zarah. And so what happens as a result? Okay, the result happens that the miracle takes place. The third thing, why did Haman want to kill all the Jews? Because Mordechai wouldn't bow. Think about how unbelievably irrational that is. And I don't like to make these comparisons because I think they're dangerous comparisons. But when you hear about some of the discussions in the upper echelons of the Third Reich, and I mean the upper echelon of the Third Reich, towards the end of the war when everything was crumbling, and the monomania about wiping out as many Jews as possible in spite of what it would cost in the war effort, it's kind of this kind of thing, irrational thinking. It's just nuts. And Haman's attempt to kill a whole bunch of people because one guy's not bowing is way off the charts. And of course the end was that Haman ended up on the same tree that he planted, that he set up for Mordechai. And the last one is that why did Ahasuerus have the Chronicles brought? It's kind of a strange thing that he said, because Haman and Esther invited Haman to the party, so he thinks there's some collusion going on. He's looking for a friend, but it's all irrational. So now, notice what Rav Hunas picked up on. He said that even though the Pasuk in its context is a reasonable, rational, rhetorical question, three R's, which is, why did the Jews get to have this holiday? And the answer is because they accepted upon themselves and for their children, etc. But within the Midrash, it becomes a point to saying this entire story is irrational, and it's all based on the fact that the key players make weird decisions that don't make any sense. And the key players here are Ahasuerus and Haman. Mordechai is not the irrational guy here, not the way he's presented. So it's two of them are Ahasuerus and two of them are Haman. But notice the difference. So I wanted to go back to what we said at the beginning. Rabbi Yitzchak in Eretz Yisrael, his take on it is, that miracle happened in Chutz Lartz. That doesn't count. No challah. In Bavel, their take was, the miracle that happened here is a fine miracle. After all, Mitzrayim. And so therefore, they essentially see the experience of the redemption in our story as approximating the redemption from Mitzrayim. Let's go back to Mitzrayim for a second. In Mitzrayim, there are overt miracles, and the overt miracles are the plagues. Moshe walks in and says, frogs, and then frogs. Overt plagues. But there's another miracle that happens underneath without which none of those other miracles happen. What is the subtle, discrete miracle throughout the story that is consistent? It doesn't change every time. It's consistent. That makes everything else happen. Vayichazek Adonai et lev Paro. God makes Paro stubborn. Even though we have a principle of free will, lev malachim biyad Hashem. The hands of the hearts of the kings are in God's hands. Leaders make irrational decisions. God is manipulating them. How it works with free will, I don't know. How that works with Torah Tagmul and proper punishment and justice, I don't know. But I do know that we see that explicitly in the text, both in the guiding Pasuk in Mishle and all these examples in the case of Paro. And so far we only see it with leaders, although not necessarily national leaders, other kind of leaders, but Paro is, of course, the impressive case. What?
Is that a perennial principle?
Good, exactly. So in Bavel, what do the Chachamim do? What does Rav Huna do? He says, let's take a look at the leaders in our story, the Paro in our story, which is Haman and Ahasuerus, because they're both our enemies, and they're both trying to destroy us, because in the Midrashic world, Ahasuerus is very aware of the plot, and is very much bought into the plot, and is desirous of seeing this plot fulfilled. And both of them act with the same irrationality as we see Paro acting. Which means in Bavel, they're looking at the story of Purim as being a replay of the story of Pesach. Which means, of course we say hallel. Of course we do. all right, we can't because we're not free. We're not totally free. We're still subjects. Or we do say it, and that's the Megillah. But not because of the Chutzlarts. There's nothing missing. All right, now, take a look at page 2. And there's something that courses through the Midrash Esther and all of the Midrashei Eretz Yisrael, which is absolutely absent in Midrashei Bavel. And it's a theme which is not once or twice, it's prominent in these Midrashim. Let's start with this. Esther fasts for 3 days, whatever that may mean, fasting for 72 hours. But Esther then comes to the king. What does Esther look like? She looks like H-E double hockey sticks. But the king has to find her very attractive to be able to agree to this. So let's take a look at what happens. Take a look at source 10. It's from the Bavli, but it's the Torah to Eretz Yisrael. Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Remember Rabbi Yochanan from Tiberia. Shloshah malachei asheret nizdamna la bota sha'a. 3 malachim came and helped Esther out. What did they do? Echad sheik biyat savara. One lifted her up. Nice posture. Echad shmashachut chokes aleh. One kind of waved some charm over her. Maybe some on-the-spot makeup. Echad shmatachat asheret. The other one picked up the scepter. Malachim all over the place. Now, when Esther comes to accuse Haman, what does she say? Ish tsar v'oyev, Haman hara hazeh. Look at the Midrash says. Melamed, in source 11, Melamed shaitam machva klapei Achashverosh. She was about to point to Achashverosh, because his name's on the decree. Uvam malach v'sata yada klapei Haman. A malach slapped her hand towards Haman. And then it continues, the Midrash continues. When the king got up and left the party because he was so enraged at this accusation and so confused, and then he comes back. Makish shiva lekima. The going out and coming back are juxtaposed, and the idea is that they're similar. Makima b'chema. Just like when he got up, he walked out, he was furious. Af shiva lekima. He went out to get a breath of fresh air and count to 100 and calm down. He came back just as angry. Why did he come back just as angry? Watch this. The azal v'ashkach l'malachei asharet t'idmulei k'garbi v'ka'akri l'ran d'bustani. He went outside and he saw malachim, who appeared to be gardeners, and were uprooting all of his trees in his garden. So he leaves the palace because the accusation is that Haman wants to kill the queen and all of her people, and he's angry. He comes out, he goes outside, and what does he see? A bunch of guys uprooting all his trees. He said, what are you doing? Haman told us to do this, which of course is fantastic because it just confirms Achashverosh's anxiety that Haman is really trying to take over. He comes back in, and what happened? There's Haman on the bed. But wait a second, we're not done. Nofel, nafal mi ba'alei. If the pasuk says Haman nofel al amita, he is falling. Should be he fell. Amar Rabbi Elazar melamed sheba malach v'pilo aleha. That Haman stood in front of Esther begging for his life, and a malach gave him a good kick you know where and knocked him over right onto Esther. Amar vaymi beita vaymi bara. And Ahasuerus says, woe to me, outside is dangerous, inside is dangerous, they're out to get me everywhere. All right, Jerry Rafferty. Now, remember this, I'm stuck in the middle with you. Okay, now, who is it who is introducing all these malachim into the palace? And we're not done with malachim. Okay, when, after the first day of fighting, Achashverosh gets a report of those who were killed and says to Esther, and then says, what do you want? And if you look at the pasuk, there's like this weird zigzag. He starts out, he sounds accusatory. Jews have killed all these people. But what do you want? It sounds weird. So Ariyavah melameh sheba malach ustarol piv. A malach came and slapped him in the mouth. And then he straightened up and he said, okay, Esther, what do you want? Now, where are all these malachim coming from? They all come from one place. Rabbi Avahu, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yochanan, all Eretz Yisrael. Why? Why are Chachmei Eretz Yisrael so intent on having Malachim move things in this story? What is the key line inside the key part of the Haggadah? So what's the key part of the Haggadah? The core of the Haggadah. The essential mitzvah of the Haggadah is Arami Oved Avi. The four verses. What's the core line in all of those midrashim in the four verses, which is the only embedded midrash, a midrash within a midrash? Vayotzienu. What is Vayotzienu? He took us out. Lo al yedei malach, velo al yedei saraf, velo al yedei shaliach, which, by the way, is a very pointed, subtle jab at Christianity. Ela HaKadosh Baruch Hu b'chvado ve'atzmo shenemar. And then they quote the pasuk, V'yavarti v'eretz Yisrael b'alai la'zev, v'kiti kol b'chor v'eretz Yisrael v'shadim v'lim. Right? V'yikol ani Hashem. Correct? So now there's four. V'yavarti, ani v'lo malach. V'kiti, eseh shvatim, ani v'lo shaliach, ani Hashem, ani hu v'lo acher. Yitziyat Mitzrayim was lo ayde malach. Purim was ayde malachim. Purim is chutz la'aretz. When you redeem the chutz la'aretz, you need malachim left and right. That's to take in Eretz Yisrael. Neisir b'chutz la'aretz. What's it take? What's it take in Bavel? The same exact things that are happening to Paro and Mitzrayim are happening to the kings here. They're having weird and irrational decisions that lead to very costly results and bad consequences for them, including getting killed and hanging up in the air. What we see here is, we'll end with what we started. If you ask the question, how did the rabbis look at the miracle of Purim? The answer has got to be what the answer almost always is when you ask that question, machloket. But that sounds like a cliche and a joke, so I'll say it better. It said there are various perspectives within rabbinic thinking about this, just like there are about Mashiach and about the importance of your own initiative when it comes to Hashgacha. Every major question, there are a range of answers. And here there are very clearly two different schools in understanding how we should appreciate what Purim is. And it takes us to an interesting halacha that last year was a practical halacha. And will be again within a year or two. What happens when there are two Adars? When do we have Purim? Let me ask it differently. When should we have Purim? Should be the first. Because after all, what's the general rule? Ein ma'avirin hama mitzvot. You don't postpone mitzvot. So why do you put it all the way to Adar Sheni? Makes no sense. So the Gemara says, Snichat ge'ula le'ge'ula. Why? Why do we want to have Purim be next to Pesach? So the two opposite approaches to this. Opposite approaches. Approach one, because Pesach is, if you will, the Av of Purim. Purim is sort of like a shadow of Pesach. It's a latter-day Pesach. That's one perspective. And therefore, they should be near each other. The other opposite perspective is, Pesach is Tchilat HaNisin, and Purim is Sof HaNisin. Esther's the end of the cycle. So to make a full cycle, we wanted to draw the two of them close to each other. They're very different. Either you're drawing them close to each other because they are basically similar experiences, or you're drawing them close to each other because they form a full circle going from intense, overt miracles to this other angels kind of, you know, quasi thing that doesn't even rate a hollow. And it happens in Chutz La'aretz. Two different perspectives on what we're going to celebrate in a week.
Okay. Well, I think